Okay. So for Parshas Vayetze, again, if you have the blue chumashim, you're on page 69, and the Torah goes back and tells us the background to the whole trickery of Lavan, how Yaakov loved Rachel. He offered his services to work for Lavan for 7 years. And Lavan agrees to the conditions. It's clear in Pasuk Yutes. Tov tisi osal lach, mi tisi osal ish acher. So they had an agreement. But, you know, Lavan doesn't necessarily live up to his agreement. And therefore, in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Yaakov says after the 7 years, Hova es ishti. Now, you know, the 7 years are up. Now it's your turn to live up to your part of the bargain. And after Lavan gathers together the people, they make this wedding banquet. And sure enough, in Pasuk Chaf Gimel, Vayhi Ba'erev, what does Lavan do? He takes Leah and he switches Rachel with Leah. And Leah now shows up. And of course, Yaakov Avinu is up in arms in Pasuk Chaf Hey. Vayomer Lavan Mazosa Sisali Lama Rimisani. I don't know how to translate the word Rimisani. I call it trickery, but there may be a better English word for that.
Deceit.
Okay, so maybe Rimia could be deceived. And then Lavan gives, you know, Lavan doesn't get this file here, you know, he's not very emotional about the whole thing. He just makes a statement, you know, to the effect that this is not what goes in our area. And therefore he makes him a deal that for another 7 years he'll give him Rachel.
Wow.
Now, the question that we want to ask over here is that when Yaakov reveals that he's been deceived, what exactly happened at that moment? The Torah, I think, is a little bit concealing about that. Was there any... You know, we have two Torahs. We have the Torah Shebichsav and, of course, the Torah Shebal Peh. But in Torah Shebichsav, there's not much, if anything, about a discussion between Yaakov and Leah. And as the Torah focuses all its attention on the discussion, the claims and counterclaims of Yaakov and Lavan, we, you know, the curious rational mind, you know, again, maybe it's a little bit what you call yentaship on our part, but, you know, a good yenta, you know, like me, would love to know what happened between Yaakov and Leah. I mean, after all, Leah was an accomplice to the crime.
Yeah.
She knew very well that the marriage was meant to be between Yaakov and her sister Rachel. Yes. And yet she agreed to this whole deception to show up and, in a sense, allow Yaakov to consummate the marriage with her, with Leah, rather than with her sister Rachel.
Well, they're all in on it, aren't they? Even Rachel was in on it.
Correct. But, you know, Rachel would be the next day. You know, there's no question that...
Wow.
That Rachel would have to defend herself to Yaakov, answer up to him. But, you know, you wonder about that very evening exactly what happened. And there are various statements in Chazal. Yeah, from what?
Because the thing is, you would think that Yaakov would know, even though it was nighttime, he would know by the voice or by the sound or by the difference.
Right, so that's another shir I once gave. If you want, I'll send you a link to it. I'm not going to go over that. There's a whole long discussion about that.
He knew about it. She knew about it.
There's a whole long discussion about that. It's a fascinating parasha. And believe it or not, the Rush, who was one of the Gedolei Chachmei Ashkenaz 1,000 years ago, he wrote a work on Chumash. And in his work on Chumash, he actually derives some really far-out conclusions as to why Yaakov didn't discern that it was Leah. But my question for today, again, every question requires another shiur, is was there some sort of, as we say in modern Hebrew, du-siach, you know, some sort of dialogue, and what was the substance of that dialogue between Yaakov and Leah? So this we don't find in Torah Shebichsav.
Yes.
But we find a discussion about this in the Medrash in Torah Sheba'al Peh. So if you have the pages that I gave you, you're looking at the second paragraph on page 103. And according to the Bereishis Rabbah, Yaakov actually turns to Leah and he accuses her of being deceptive. And not only that, you are Rama'it, you know, a deceptive individual. You are the daughter of a Rama'i, you know, as if to imply it's in the genes, you know, you had a very good teacher here. And how is it possible that you responded to my calling out and you said, yes, this is Rachel, when in fact it was, you know, you knew very well you are Leah, not Rachel. And the amazing thing about this Medrash is the response of of Leah to Yaakov's very sharp
accusation.
And what does Leah say in self-defense? Unbelievable. She says to him a rhetorical question: have you ever seen a student without a teacher? Every disciple has to have an instructor. Now, she says to him, do you remember an old blind man who wanted to give his older son a blessing, and instead his younger son shows up, and when the father asks him, are you my older son? He responds, yes, I am. I have a teacher, says Leah. I'm not the original, I didn't write the course description on deception 1.1, you know, in the University of Toronto. Yeah, I was a disciple. You were the one who taught the first course. You're the instructor. And Yaakov has to admit that he decided, you know, when Yitzhak called him and said, are you my b'char? He did say yes. Again, we had a long discussion about this last week, if you were around. But be that as it may. Now, this medrash can be understood on so many different levels. You know, on a psychological level, in terms of relationship between a husband and a wife, a very new husband and wife, and not even a what you call a happy husband, you know, for sure. You could understand it on one level. But, you know, Chazal, when they give us midrashim, and they become incorporated into what we call netzach, into the eternity and infinity of Torah, there must be a deeper meaning here. The very harsh words that, on the one hand, Yaakov hurls at Leah, and then Leah responds, you know, to really rip it into him. And it's almost, I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase, hit him below the belt. You know, this is really something of an accusation on Leah's part. Not something that we would necessarily have anticipated Leah of responding. Now, that is going to be the main question, officially, as far as our discussion today, our study of Parshas Vayetzeh. However, this is a shear within a shear. And I'm not sure, but I think that the next part of the shiur, which has nothing to do with our parsha, well, it does, but only incidentally, is really the main part of the shiur. And that's to start now, I guess you'd call it Roman numeral number 2, for our discussion today, a Gemara Masechta Shabbos. Towards the end of Shabbos, the Gemara talks about the beauty and the intensity, the profound experience of Shabbos. And the Gemara says the following: Kol hama'aneg es ha-shabbos. The Gemara is going to tell us about the rewards for someone who is quote-unquote ma'aneg es ha-shabbos. Please note, we're going to come back to this again and again. It doesn't say misha mis'aneg b'shabbos, that on the Shabbos he enjoys the oneg of Shabbos, the pleasures of Shabbos, but he's ma'aneg es ha-shabbos. It's almost like he's grabbing the Shabbos as an object, and he's doing something vis-a-vis the object, in this case, vis-a-vis the Shabbos. So we'll have to rack our brains. But in any event, just on a superficial level, the Gemara is going to tell us what kind of reward can we anticipate for the great mitzvah of owning Shabbos. Now, when I say the great mitzvah of owning Shabbos, truth is, I don't even have to be motivated by a reward. My wife's chont is excellent. And I'm sure everyone here could rave about, you know, whenever Onik Shabbos, they, you know, back in the yeshiva days, there was an unofficial permission for yeshiva guys to raid the chont on Friday night. Mm-hmm. Now, truth be told, in some yeshivas, they were very mocked about it. But in other yeshivas, they sort of look the other way, and the Talmidim understood from that we're allowed to raid the cholent on Friday night. Other people, you may know, have a minhag of tasting from Shabbos on Erev Shabbos. Yeah. Right? And that's called Toamer Chaim Zachu. You know, so the mitzvah of honing Shabbos is really a broad mitzvah. It begins Erev Shabbos and it continues throughout the entire Shabbos. But Chazal have an unbelievable reward for us for this mitzvah of honing Shabbos. And they say, Nosnim lo nachla b'li mitzarim. Now the word nachla, almost by definition, means within a certain boundaries. It means an inheritance, an estate, that is bound on all four sides. But Chazal have invented, if you will, a new term, a new concept called nachla b'li mitzarim. It is an estate that has no bounds. It's endless. Obviously, this so-called estate means our portion in the world to come, our reward. And in the ultimate infinite reward, there's something that goes beyond any boundaries whatsoever. And that's the reward for Onik Shabbos. Where does the Gemara from whence does the Gemara derive this very radical conclusion about the incredible infinite reward for Onik Shabbos? From a parsha in Yeshayahu, Perek Nunches. That Perek deals with all what we call, again, this is more for a halachic discussion, what we call the Divrei Kabbalah part of Shabbos. You know, Shabbos has three parts to it. There's Doraisa, which itself could be broken down into two parts. That's the Lamentes Melachos of Mechalel Mos Yumas, and then the positive command of Zohar Yom Shabbos L'Kadsho. And then we drop down to the other extreme, which is called Derabbanan, otherwise known as Shvus. And then right in the middle, we have something called Divrei Kabbalah. Divrei Kabbalah are those dimensions of Shabbos which, although they're not written in the five books of Moses, but they are written in Tanakh, in this case in Yeshayahu Perek Nunches, and those are Kvod Shabbos and Oreg Shabbos and V'davu Dovah, for example, you know, the way we speak on Shabbos, all that fits into that middle case, that middle category called Divrei Kabbalah. That's for halachic discussion. But what is Yeshayahu Hanavi telling us? So if you look carefully at the pasuk, he says, "Oz tis'anig el Hashem." If you're ma'anig the Shabbos, then you have an oneg, so to speak, together with God. Obviously, the reward in the world to come. Ver kavticha al bavasei aretz. God says, "I will, so to speak, give you a piggyback ride on the ends of the earth." You know, it's even beyond the bounds of the earth. Now this is very interesting. I will bestow upon you, literally I will give you to eat, so to speak, to consume a portion, a nachla. And Yeshayahu HaNavi identifies that nachla as the nachla of Yaakov. Now keep in mind, we have how many avos?
Three.
You know, each av gets a nachla. HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises a piece of real estate, not just to Yaakov Avinu, but also to Avram and to Yitzchak. And yet, when Yeshayahu wants to single out this so-called Nachla B'li Mitzarim, this endless, infinite estate that's going to be our reward for Onik Shabbos, it identifies, this singles out Yaakov Avinu. What's unique about the Nachla of Yaakov Avinu? So the answer is, in a pasuk in this week's parsha, maybe it's in last week's parsha. I'm sorry, let me just see. Chaf Ches, Pasuk, Yudalid. No, it's at the very beginning of this week's parsha, actually. If you're a Lubavitcher, you're very into this pasuk. Okay, this is on page 66 in the Blue Chumashim, going on to 67. V'hayazaracha, God promises that Yaakov's descendants, Kafar Ha'aretz, will multiply like the dust of the earth. Oh. And then the famous pasuk, and I can sing it for you because I'm a Lubavitcher, seven generations on my father's side. Ufaratzta yom avakei matzafon avanei. Ufaratzta yom avakei. Remember it? Okay. Everybody knows that one, even if you're not a Lubavitcher. Now, it's very interesting that the Nachla of Yaakov Avinu and his descendants is described by all four directions. You know, usually if I want to isolate a piece of property, a piece of real estate, I'll tell you it's the southeast section or the northwest section. You know, here it says no. It's Ufaratzta. Ufaratzta means to break all the bounds. So Yaakov Avinu, amongst the three Avos, gets a certain reward, a certain promise, a divine promise that is very unique. And the Medrash goes on to say the following: Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, Kol Hama'aneg Es HaShabbos Nosnim Lo Mishalos libo v'chulei v'chulei v'amema ango. Give me an example of Onik Shabbos. And he says b'tavshil shel taradin. My taradin is some sort of very special vegetable, maybe spinach if you like spinach. Dogim gedolim and large fish. Rashi shumin, you know, plenty of garlic. You know, Hasidim are into dogim, you know, they're into the fish. You know, if my wife serves a meal and my shver is there and there's no fish on the table on Shabbos, forget it. Avu is the fish, you know, we have to have fish, you know. So Rashi explains that a tavshil shel tardin is chashavu. This kind of vegetable is very, it's a very significant vegetable. Probably was very expensive, very tasty. It wasn't something that you could, And basically what it means is that a person should dedicate the best of his foods, the most chashav of his foods, what we call ma'adanim, the tastiest foods, for Onik Shabbos. And that's what we really try to do. The only thing that we don't do on Shabbos is steak. That's, you know, for those of you who are steak lovers, that's a problem, because it's very hard to eat a steak if it's not coming right out of the sizzling broiler. You know what I mean? So on Shabbos it's a little bit complicated. So therefore things like roast chicken are much easier, and you know, I'm watering already at the mouth thinking of this coming Shabbos. My wife is now in Chutzlar, she's going to be back for Shabbos.
Wow.
The Gemara on Daf Kuf Yud Ches goes on to explain why is it that Yaakov is singled out over here. The Gemara says, Lo kenachlas Avram, not like the portion that was promised Avram, because by Avram it says, Kum hishalich ba'aretz li'arka. In other words, go and see how far you can get, if you're going to the width, if you're going to the breadth of the land of Israel. Eretz zu v'lo yoser. Rashi points out here that it means, this is the land that you're going to inherit, and not beyond that. Now we're on page 104. In Yitzchak it says, Etein l'chas kol ha'artzos ha'el. And again, it's very well defined and limited. But in the case of Yaakov, it says, Ufaratzta. And the word Ufaratzta is very significant. It's Miloshen lifrotz, or poretz, which means to break down all the boundaries. You know, today in modern Hebrew, when you want to talk about a robber who robs a bank, you say the following, who pagatz et a bank, you know, he broke into the bank, you know. And that's what it means. If you want to talk about someone who goes beyond, you know, the laws of tzius, which are well circumscribed, you call him, he's a poreitz geder, you know, he breaks all the bounds. Yaakov Avinu is granted this beautiful divine promise of ufaratzta, and that means that his portion, which he, of course, bequeaths to his ancestors, his descendants, is not limited. Uparatzta means it breaks all the bounds. And that's the nature of the nachla that we're going to receive in Mitzvah Hashem as reward for the mitzvah of what? Right. Of Onik Shabbos. And now we want to understand, what is the midah keneged midah here? Because, okay, a person is ma'anigas haShabbos. I don't want to detract from that. You know, it's great to eat a good Shabbos meal and enjoy it, gishmak. But therefore, he gets a nachla b'li mitzarim. Why is that an appropriate reward, midah, measure for measure? And here at this point, we introduce the Maral Niprak. Okay, this is going to be the basis for our entire thesis. The Maral points to a Gemara in Kiddushin. And based on this Gemara, he sees worlds in this Gemara. Worlds, I mean depths that go beyond human comprehension. And this Gemara is going to give the Maral Niprag an insight into the entire parsha of Yaakov Avinu that we learned last Shabbos, stealing as it were, or fooling his father, and taking the brachas. And the Maral is bothered by this question. Yaakov is emes. How could Yaakov have stolen the brachas? And again, there are many different approaches. The Maral has a very, very unique approach. I would call it metaphysical, meaning it's not psychological. We tried last week to explain Yaakov's actions on a more psychological level, but on a metaphysical level based on this Gemara and Kiddush. Now let me just give you my own humble summary of the essence of the Gemara and Kiddush, and then we'll look at it inside, and you'll tell me whether you think I was right in my summary. The Gemara tells us that when a person comes into this world, the divine being already carves out for him, for that person, him or her, a possible portion in Gan Eden. When I say possible, it's potential, you know, and you have to live up to it and deserve it. And the opposite. a portion in the other place. You know, Gehenna. You know, we don't want to call it by its name, but you know. And basically, God is waiting to see what a person's going to do in their lifetime. And if they are zocheh, if they do the right thing, then adarabah, they get this portion in Gan Eden that was designated for them. They live up to their potential. If the opposite, let them inherit this portion in Gehenna. That's not enough. The Gemara goes beyond that, and the Gemara says the following. Imagine the case of two individuals. Each one has his designated allotment in Gan Eden and the opposite, the negative, in Gehenna. One of them, Baruch Hashem, he's a tzaddik, he lives up to his calling, to his, you know, to his responsibility in life, and that's great. The other one, just the opposite. He messes up. Instead of being religious and observant, bless you, he falls prey to all the influences. He becomes Hashem or Rosh. So the Gemara says as follows. The first guy is going to inherit not only his portion in Gan Eden, but he's going to pick up his friend's portion in Gan Eden. He gets a double portion. His friend, on the other hand, inherits not only his designated portion in Gehenna, but he gets also the first guy's portion in Gehenna. Let's see it inside and see if what I told you is correct. The Gemara tells us the following. Bashamayim, up in the heavens, Misharim im holodosa shel kol adam, they estimate or evaluate with the birth of every individual, lemayu chal lagia b'chayv, what's the potential he can achieve in his lifetime? How high can he climb and ascend in his spiritual climb? And the Shamayim makes an umdana means an assessment, and they assess, you know what, given all the factors, this is what the potential is, and therefore they carve out a place for him in Gan Eden. On the other hand, they realize that he has a tremendous, I don't know if you want to call it potential, but a negative potential to reach the bottom of the barrel, and therefore they give him a very honorable place, so to speak, B'lashon Saginar, in Gehenna. After the years and years that a person lives on this earth, then when he goes up for the judgment, they begin to look and investigate into his mitzvos and fakeret his averos. If he's a tzaddik, his friend is a rasha, then the tzaddik gets not only his portion that was designated from the beginning of time, but also he gets another additional portion in Gan Eden that was designated for his friend who unfortunately forfeited his rights to that portion because he was a Rosh. The Rosh, on the other hand, is going to receive his portion in Gehenna, but not only that, he's going to inherit a double portion in Gehenna, his friend's portion in Gehenna. That's what it says in the Gemara. And there are many different interpretations of this Gemara. Who are these two people? What is the relationship between them? Is one having an impact on the other? And so forth and so on. The Maharal Prague sees something in this Gemara, which, again, I'll speak for myself, I would never have seen it in a million years. First of all, he quotes a pasuk in Shmuel, in Tanakh, the pasuk which you'll see at the end of the paragraph, Anu Yodim, Ki ha'adam yira le'enayim v'ashem yira le'levav. That as a general rule, again, we're going to soon see one exception to the rule, man doesn't have that perception that God has, the divine being. Man usually judges things externally, superficially. You see a person, he looks like a really good guy. You know, in his relationships, he's very cordial. He always has a smile on his face. He's the first one to say good morning to you. But you know what? Hashem knows a lot about this person that you don't know. You only have an interaction, an interchange with him on the outside. What happens when this guy gets home to his family? Is he gruff? Is he rough with his wife? Does he get angry at his children? So you judged him chitzonit, you know, from the externalities. You can have a person who on the outside, he's not so friendly, he's quite quiet, he doesn't impress you in any way, but yet, in the privacy of his home, he's absolutely wonderful. He's so caring, he's so giving and kind. Hashem is the one who, as the pasuk says, is yirul levav. He knows the truth in the essence of a person. And sometimes to know the essence of the person, you have to see how he behaves behind closed doors. You know, not as he does in the public. He says on the bottom paragraph that the only exception to this rule, the people who you can designate as having that divine insight, and they know a person l'levav to his heart, and they're not tricked or fooled by the externalities, are the Avos HaKadoshim. The Avos and the Imos were, shall I say, incredibly divine in this particular area, says the Maharal Mipraat. They could, to use the Yiddish phrase, shots up a person. They could evaluate a person. Lalevav, to his heart. And therefore the Maharal says, what are you telling me about Yitzchak? Yitzchak was fooled by Esav? Could it be? Yitzchak is one of the great Avos. He has this perception. Esav comes forward and he says, well, should I be mafrish meiser from melach, from salt? What is Yitzchak, a fool? Do we really judge Yitzchak on such a superficial level to say that Yitzchak was tricked by Esav? Oh no. Says the Maharal Mipraat, Yitzchak knew very well that Rivka's right. Esav is just doing this on the outside. But Yitzchak looks into the heart of Esav, and he's not willing to despair. He's not willing to give up hope. He is the typical or personification, if you will, the archetypal father who has compassion on a son. Says the Maharal Mipraat, Yitzchak sees in Esav a tremendous potential. He realizes that at this stage in his life, Esav is not deserving of a blessing. He's a Rasha. However, Yitzchak, and this you'll see on the bottom of your page 104, going on to the top of 105, Yitzchak is Kiva. Kiva means he has hopes that maybe we could be Makarev Esav, give him this bracha mitala shamayim mishmani ha'aretz, and maybe the bracha itself will somehow impact and penetrate into the heart of Esav, and bring him to the state of tshuva. Maybe he'll start thinking, I didn't act properly to Yerushalayim, and he's going to become a tzaddik. Mm. And if you take a look at the Gemara in Megillah, which is here on the top of your page 105, the Gemara says that even after Yitzchak realized that it was Yaakov who took the brachos, even at that point, Chazal tell us in the Gemara in Megillah, based on again a pasuk in Yeshayahu HaNavi, Yuchan Rasha. Meaning, Yitzchak turns to Ribbono Shel'olam and he says, Yuchan. Yuchan means V'lashon Chen. Can the divine being see a possibility of Chen, of having grace, of having compassion on Esav? Maybe we could find another bracha. You know, the first bracha Esav didn't receive was taken away by Yaakov. Maybe there's a chance for Yitzchak, for Esav. And the Gemara tells the Megillah that Hashem's response was very harsh. Mm-hmm. Was what we call in modern Hebrew chad mashmei, you know, can only be understood in one way. No room for interpretation. On Allah HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God responds to Yitzchak, Harehu, this individual, Esav, Yachriv es Beis HaMikdash. He will have generations that will ultimately, he is responsible for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. At that point, the end of the pasuk in Yeshaya reflects Yitzchak's response. Yitzchak throws his hands up in heaven and he says, Bal Yira Begavas Hashem. Gavas Hashem means the plenty of God, the greatness of God. Esav is out. At this point, Yitzchak realized that Rivka is right. Esav has crossed all bounds, all red lines. There's no chance for Yitzchak. Again, no chance for Esav. As long as Yitzchak still was holding out some sort of a hope, he, Yitzchak, wanted to bestow the blessing upon Esav with the hope that maybe Esav would inherit, if he does tshuva, his portion that was allotted to him from the get-go in Gan Eden. However, now at this point, Yitzchak realizes he made a big mistake. Esav is going to get one portion. But which portion he's going to get? Not Gan Eden, but the opposite, but Gehenna. Who else at that moment in time realized that Esav is not going to get Gan Eden, but Gehenna? Yaakov Avinu. Here's something fascinating. And this is the main chiddush of the Maharal. This is what I call Lafoch HaSakor Al Piyah. He turns everything upside down. Yaakov, with his insight, understood what his father Yitzchak did not necessarily understood until the very end. Yaakov understood, as Rivka before him, that Esav had crossed all the lines. And therefore, what happens now in this relationship between Yaakov and Esav? Not only is Esav going to forfeit his portion in Gan Eden, and is he going to acquire and inherit his portion in Gehenna? But based on the Gemara that we saw in Masechta Shabbos, it's going to be, Masechta Kedushin, excuse me, it's going to be more than that. Yaakov Avinu is going to get what? A double portion of Gan Eden, and Esav is going to get a double portion of Gehenna. Yaakov is going to inherit the portion of Gan Eden that was originally allotted for Esav. And therefore, when Micha HaNavi says at the end of Tanakh, Titein Emes Li Yaakov, Hashem, you gave the truth into the heart of Yaakov, Yaakov understood that when he would declare in front of his father, this is the Maharal's unique approach, Anochi Esav Bechorecha, what he meant was that relative to the bracha of Gan Eden, of Yiten Lecha Mital HaShamayim, I am Esav. What did Yaakov mean when he said that relative to the bracha, I am Esav? I deserve the bracha, which means the Gan Eden, of Esav. And therefore, Yaakov Avinu is not being gonev das oviv. He's not tricking his father. He, in fact, is taking that which is rightfully his. In other words, the portion that was allotted to Esav, that Yitzchak now wants to bestow upon Esav, that bracha, really doesn't belong to Esav. Esav has no claim to that portion. It's Yaakov Avinu who has that claim, because the Gemara says in Masechta Kiddushin that the tzaddik will inherit not only his portion of Gan Eden, but his friend who's a Rosh's portion in Gan Eden. And if this be the case, says the Maharal Prague, we can shed a whole new light on the discussion that took place between Leah and Yaakov on that fateful night of deceit, so to speak. The marriage of Yaakov to the daughters of Lavan were known. The Gemara tells us in the Masechta Bava Basra that the people on the street, the Ovrei Derech, used to gossip, and they said, well, Lavan has two daughters, and Yitzchak has two sons. Hagadol Yisas Hagadola Vakotn Yisas Hakatana. In other words, Esav, who's the older brother, he's designated to get married with Leah, the older sister. I'm sorry, did I get that right?
No, you got it right.
Yeah, I got that right. I usually don't, but you know, there's so many different names here. It's like Scrabble. Yeah. And the younger of the two brothers, that's Yaakov, is designated for the younger of the two sisters, that's Rachel. That was the original plan. Leah, on the other hand, was a true prophetess, a Nevi'ah, like all the other Imos, and she understood that the schar of Esav would be that he would marry her, Leah, but on the other hand, if Esav would forfeit his schar, because he would become a Rasha, he no longer had rights to marry Leah. Leah now would be designated for Yaakov Avinu, because Leah would now inherit that right. Let me read it to you inside. This is on page 105 at the end of the paragraph Nisuav, and he says the following. He says that Leah haitamiu editli Esav, but that's only if Esav would do tshuva and he would overcome his tendency to do evil. Leah, with her great prophecy, understood Shahisa Chelik Measharam Yud Lchol Adam Im Yaskil Lidvok Bitzikoso Esav Hismid Birshu. So Ibed Aschus Hazul Kabal Es Leah Hatzadekes Ulakach Avrol Yaakov. In other words, Yaakov would inherit any schus, any claim that Esav would have. Once Esav was a tried and true, well-established Rasha. And therefore, since it was Esav who had rights to marry the tzaddikess Leah, now that Yaakov is inheriting the rights of his brother Esav, because Esav is a Rasha, Yaakov now takes over those rights, and if I could add my own responsibilities, to marry Leah. And now the relationship between Yaakov and Leah is an exact, how shall I say, a repercussion of the fact that Esav is a confirmed Rasha. Now we begin to understand, says the Maral Miprag, this dialogue, as we called it, this dusiach, the strange dusiach between Yaakov and Leah, according to the Medrash on that night. Yaakov says to Leah, how did you deceive me and present yourself as if you were Rachel? And Leah's response is, well, you deceived your father. And the answer is, you were legitimate in that deception because Esav forfeited his rights to his chelik of Gan Eden. You therefore took over those rights, and therefore you deserve the Bechorah, you deserve both blessings. So too, says Leah, by analogy, I also deserve a better portion. I was originally designated for Esav, but Esav lost his rights to marry me because he is a confirmed Rasha, and therefore at this point, you, Yaakov, inherit those rights and responsibilities to marry me. Now again, this doesn't mean that therefore Lavan is off the hook. I mean, Lavan obviously is the evildoer here. But nevertheless, in terms of the plan and the rights, now Leah takes over those rights from Esav, just like Yaakov took over those rights from Esav. And if this be the case, my friends, and now we're on the top of page 106, we begin to understand why Yaakov gets the blessing, the description of Ufaratzta. What does Ufaratzta mean? This is fascinating, Rabosa. Let's imagine that you go out to battle against the enemy. Well, if you succeed and you're victorious in that military campaign, you take over the lands or the possessions of your enemy. That's called Ufaratzta. Yaakov Avinu is the personification of Ufaratzta. Why? Because he goes beyond his own bounds, his allotment to Gan Eden, and enters into the enemy's field, so to speak, and takes over his ground. Yaakov Ufaratzta, he calls it Azus the Kedusha, in other words, it's a certain chutzpah, but it's a sanctified Kedusha, is to go into Esav and convert that evil of Esav into good and take over the portion of Gan Eden of Esav. In other words, when a person, or nation successfully breaks into the territory of the enemy and they take the booty, that's called, in the language of Micha Novi, Ola HaPeretz Lifneim, Miloshen Peretz. Now Peretz also has another meaning. If you recall, Tamar gives birth to twins, and one of them she calls Peretz. That twin, that boy named Peretz, is going to ultimately be the father of Mashiach. Mashiach ben David. Right? Because Yehuda is the father of David. When I say the father, you know what I mean. And Peretz is going to be the father of David. So it comes out that the ultimate Geula of Klal Yisrael is a result of Peretz. Right? The Mashiach is related to Peretz. For example, Yeshayahu HaNavi, and this you'll see on the outside of the so-called United Nations. Don't get me started on that. It says, "V'kitesu charbosom li'itim." They will convert their swords into plowsheds, right? That's how they translate it. Mm-hmm. He says, what's the whole idea of Yeshayahu HaNavi? He's saying that, you know, your enemy has certain evil about him. And Klal Yisrael is going to take that evil and convert it into good and transform it. Why? Because we have this uparatzta. We have this ability, as Yaakov Avinu goes to be porates into Esav and take Esav's portion, we have the ability to take the charvos, you know, the swords and the ammunitions of our adversaries, the evildoers, and upgrade them into itim. Itim means into plowsheds, right? Into something positive. That's called ufaratzta. We begin now to understand, perhaps, why the reward for Onik Shabbos is going to be that infinite portion of Yaakov Avinu. And the answer is that man is a hybrid being made up of two parts. On the one hand, man is spiritual, that's his neshama tahora, his pure soul, and all the mitzvahs that he does, and all the chesed that he perpetrates in this world, any good that he gives to others, kindness and compassion, all that comes from the neshama tahora. But man is also made up of another part, which is a little bit less pure, and that's his gashmius, his physicality, his body. His body needs to eat and to sleep and so forth. a person could say, you know what? These two parts of my personality, my hybrid nature, can coexist, but each one is separate. There's like a mechitza, a partition between the two. Gamizev, gamizel tanach yodecha, as Shlomo Melech says. Meaning, I have to feed the soul, and I have to feed the body. But in this case, there's no ufaratzta. Because what's ufaratzta? Ufaratzta is not just a harmony between two sides, you know. But rather, ufaratzta means an integrity, or an integration, if you will. Ufaratzta means when the tzaddik has the ability to cross the boundaries from the neshama tahora into the guf, and to tzarchei haguf, and convert the swords into plowsheds. Ufaratzta means to take the guf, which could be viewed in a sense as the enemy, and upgrade it and uplift it to the level of ruchaniyut, of spirituality, of neshama tahora. That's called ufaratzta. To take all those needs that are physical and bring them under the domain of avodas Hashem, of serving Hashem. That's what's unique about Shabbos, and specifically about Oneg Shabbos. Shabbos is a day of spirituality, it's a day of Neshama Yisera, of Tefillah, of Torah, all that is true. But there's another dimension to Shabbos, and that's to be Ma'aneg Es HaShabbos, to take the Shabbos and convert it into Oneg. To take those physical actions, as we said before, of eating a good Gishmak Cholent, and upgrade them and uplift those actions into the level of Neshama Torah of Gan Eden. That's Ufaratzta. That means following in the footsteps of Yaakov Avinu. And therefore, it makes absolute sense that the reward that's bestowed upon a person for Oneg Shabbos is going to be breaking all the bounds. It's going to be the Nachla of Yaakov Avinu, which is a Nachla B'li Mitzarim. It's boundless. It doesn't set up boundaries between the physical and the materiality of man and the pure spirit of man. But rather we go back to the original concept of creation, which is an integration of both neshama and guf. The Zohar calls Shabbos Yoma Dinishmasin, the day of the neshama, which means that even the neshama can eat and drink and sleep on Shabbos. Why? Because even the physicality can be considered ruchaniyut, can be considered upgraded to the level of spirituality. And therefore, on this day, when we breathe the air of the Neshama Yisera that was given to us, we fulfill not only the mitzvahs of Neshama of Torah and Tefillah, but we want to enter into the world of materiality, of physicality, of the pleasures of the guf, and convert them and channel them and inspire them to Avodas HaBorei, to serve for Hashem. That's called Hama'aniges HaShabbos. If you take a look on the top of page 107, it doesn't say Humis'aneg B'Shabbos, but it says Huma'aneg Es HaShabbos. And the difference in the language is very fundamental. He says the relationship between man and his eating and his Oneg Shabbos, which is physical on Shabbos, is that he has to put all his kochos, all his mental and all his intention into the fact that when he's enjoying the Shabbos, he's enjoying it for the sake of the Shabbos itself. He's doing it to be ma'anig the Shabbos, not for his own personal Oneg. In this, if you take a look in the paragraph Kimuvan, he tells a story about a chassid. You know, the Hasidim have a minhag that before they eat on Shabbos, any portion that's brought down, that's brought in front of them, they say L'kvod Shabbos Kodesh. Have you ever seen that? I know in Satmar they're very big on this. Kvod Shabbos Kodesh. So one of the Hasidim got up and he said L'kvod Krasi, for the benefit of my stomach. So the Hasidim asked him, why are you saying for the benefit of your stomach? So the Chassid answers, he says, you know what? When the Pasuk says that on when Chazal tell us that on Shabbos a person who's an Amah Oretz, he's not a great scholar, he has Ema Shabbos, meaning somehow the Shabbos impacts on him and he doesn't want to lie. He says, how can I lie and tell you that everything that I'm going to enjoy and every morsel and every piece of cholent that I eat is L'kavod Shabbos Kodesh? I'm not going to lie to you. I understand very well that I'm enjoying the pleasures of Shabbos. So he wanted to be honest about it. So he said, L'kavod crazy, he says. But the truth is that Oneg Shabbos is a great challenge. You know, for a person to really to be just, you know, not echad b'pev, echad b'lev, you know, not just to give lip service, but to really genuinely mean it from the depths of his heart, that he really is eating for the covenant of Shabbos to be mekayim the mitzvah of his Creator. That's a great madrigan, that's a great challenge. And that means pritzas haderech, to be poreitz derech, to conquer that area which doesn't belong, l'chora, to the neshama, to allow the spiritual part of man to go into the taivas haguf and to upgrade it, and as we said before, to integrate it into his neshama. He has a whole discussion here, which we're not going to get into, on the bottom of page 107, the top of page 108, about a person who wants to fast on Shabbos. And when they ask him, why is he fasting? He says, well, for me, that's Onik Shabbos. He says, I'm not capable of really reaching the level of eating L'Kvod Shabbos, that all my pleasures are really exclusively dedicated in a genuine, sincere way to Shabbos, and therefore, for me, the best way of observing the Shabbos is through fasting. Very strange. And the Gemara tells us about Rabbi Akiva, that they caught him crying on Shabbos. And they asked him, Rabbi Akiva, today is the mitzvah of Onik Shabbos, why are you crying? And his answer was, that HaBechi Etzli Hu Tainuk, that when I am overwhelmed with emotion and I break out in tears, that itself is a kiyum of onik. That too is acceptable. And therefore, at the top of page 108, he says that if a person says that he gets a tanug from tzom, from fasting, then we can recognize and validate that there is such a thing as a person who really... He has an oneg from fasting. I mean, my Rebbe, Zichron L'Vrach, Rav Salvechik, used to fast on a yard site. I don't know if you've seen that minute, but he would give shiurim on a yard site for hours and hours on end. Sometimes he would start as early as 9 in the morning, and he would stop at 5 in the evening. And, you know, just looking at the man, you know he's fasting. He doesn't take a break, not for a drink, not for a bite. And he keeps going. You know, you begin to think that maybe for him, fasting is an oneg. I don't know. Maybe he enjoys fasting. I don't know. In any event, what do we have to learn from this entire presentation? Halimud mikach. Here he summarizes the punchline of this entire essay. And he says that Adam, every person has to be honest with himself, make a genuine cheshbon hanefesh to introspect and evaluate himself and see what are his potentials. You know, he shouldn't be poreitz too much and try to conquer areas that he cannot possibly reach. You know, if he's going to say, well, you know, I'm going to take the Shabbos, and it says such great things about Ma'anigas HaShabbos, I'm going to eat incessantly on Shabbos. I'm going to read all the books that I love to read. I'm going to play all the games, you know, he calls them Mishakim Motchim, you know, those are, can I say that in English? Metach means
tension.
Yeah, but there's another word for it. Anyway, you know, those games that you play which have a certain element of
excitement
to it. And he says, I'm gonna eat on Shabbos, I'm gonna enjoy these old things, and everything is gonna be l'kvod Shabbos, you know, all these physical pleasures. But he forgets one thing. Okay, he wants to be poreitz deep into the field of the enemy. You know, shetach ha'oyev, you know, penetrate very, very deep behind enemy lines. But hu nishar shav, at the end of the day, he ends up behind enemy lines. Hu lo kavash klal, he wasn't able to conquer the enemy at all. And his physicality took over him. And that's not called onik shabbos. So we have to be very, very careful. And on the bottom here, page 108, he gives two examples of wars, of battles in the Torah. One is in Parshas Ki Teitzeh, and one is in Parshas Baal Loscha. But he says there's a fundamental difference between the two. In the case of Parshas Ki Teitzeh, we're going out into enemy territory, and there we need a great deal of help from Hashem. In the case of Baal Loscha, we are secure in our area, and our enemy are attacking us. And he says the following. He says, when we go out in Parshas Ki Teitzeh to attack our enemy, then we really have to provide ourselves with tremendous amount of fortification, of weapons, of arsenal, you know, protect ourselves. Because we're going to be on enemy territory. That's what he calls on a Yotzim L'Shetach HaOyev. And that's really a challenge. He says it's a little bit easier if they come to attack us. And he gives an interesting example. He says the Six-Day War in 1967, we took the initiative. The Israeli military attack before, you know, we knew that the Arabs were going to attack us. So we went into enemy territory. He says on Yom Kippur, 1973, that's about 15 years, 16 years later, right? There the enemy entered into our territory. And that's why there were so many tragedies on that Yom Kippur. He says the same thing here. When we have to evaluate ourselves and decide how we can implement Ufaratzta, you know, the Yaakov paradigm, then we have to really be honest with ourselves and evaluate our own abilities. What are our capabilities? He says that if we're going out into enemy territory, we're entering into the physicality and the materiality, in that shetach, he says, we're going to need a lot of help. We're going to need a lot of chatzotros and a lot of tfilos, and we're going lekrasa oyev, and it's dangerous there. We have to hope and pray that Hashem will give us victory in our enemy, in our attack against the enemy territory. He goes on to quote a medrash, and with this we'll conclude, that Hashem says to Yaakov Avinu to climb the ladder. And Yaakov, according to the Chazal, in the medrash, initially did not want to obey the divine command. He was afraid to climb the ladder. And when he wakes up the next morning, Yaakov declares, Hine yesh Hashem b'makom azev anochi lo yadati. I wasn't aware of Hashem's presence. Says the Zohar, Lo yadati shashem yeshno b'mistarta. I didn't know that God was concealing himself. What's going on? Yaakov is just after his 14-year stint in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'ever. He lives a full spiritual life. He fills up his belly, so to speak, b'shas and Torah and tefillah, and Hashem is with him. He sees the gili of Shechina for 14 years consecutively in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'ever. But now, he's already on his own. He's on his way to try to get married. He's entering into the physical, material world of a lavan. He's running away from an Esav. He's going to work the tzon. He's going to try to eke out a living, a parnasa. And here too, Hashem reveals himself to Yaakov. And Yaakov says, Anochi lo yadati. What was the chiddush here to Yaakov Avinu when the Shechina appeared to him at the beginning of Parashas Vayetze? Lo yadati she'efshar, I didn't know it was humanly possible. Gam ba'avodat ha'geshem, even as I go out into the physical material world, lekabel giluyim ruchaniyim, to receive these revelations from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I went to sleep. Can a person achieve a level while he's asleep? That was a new limud for Yaakov. And in the debate with Leah, he reveals something that was concealed from him. That even within the context of marriage, this kedusha, this spirituality and sanctity, don't think that just in the Shem Ve'ever, in the insulated Dalet Amos of a yeshiva, there is Gilui Shechina and only exclusively there. Oh no. There's something else. There's a Gilui Shechina in the world of physicality. What we called, if you remember last week, the Avodas Hachutz, if you recall. And therefore, maybe Yaakov Avinu was hesitant in climbing that ladder when Hashem told him to do so, because he was a yeshiva bacha. He realized that climbing that ladder would push him to challenges, to areas that he was never used to. That he would have to enter into these physical Dvarim Chomrim, and therefore Hashem had to reveal himself to Yaakov Avinu. And promise Yaakov, Anochi itcha b'chal shatelech, shmaticha baderech, I will protect you. There will be Gilui Shechina, even in the physicality. And that's what we saw with regard to the marriage and the consummation of that marriage between Leah and Yaakov. Yirotzo v'shbizoche to the mitzvah of Onik Shabbos, to really inherit the Nachla v'limitzorim of Yaakov Avinu Faratzta. We should be able to penetrate into those areas of secular life, of mundane physicality, and uplift them, integrate them into the world of the Shomet Torah, Kehi Ratzon. on me. Harvey, I think they're waiting for you downstairs. Am I right?